Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless.
I will say that about the Lego movie is I felt like if that was a Pixar movie, it would have been a decent Pixar movie. But because nobody expected that movie to be any good, it was like a great, everybody's like, best, great movie, fantastic movie. But I'm like, it was really funny, but I didn't feel like there was anything about it that's like, wow.
No, yeah. I mean, I really enjoyed the Lego movie, but I felt like I enjoyed it because a movie about Legos
shouldn't be that good.
Had no business, like, having that kind of depth to it. But, I mean, it was a really solid, it's one of the best animated movies I've seen recently because I just felt like the quality of animated movies in general has been pretty subpar.
Unless Pixar does it, yeah.
Well, I mean, and even then, Pixar's kind of been, to me, kind of letting me down a little bit because I feel like they're, at best, they're okay. Like, I didn't really enjoy Brave all that much.
Did you see Monsters University?
I have not seen Monsters University yet. I keep trying to watch it, like, every other day, and we always are like, well, let's watch this other movie instead. But
it's a lot of fun.
What was the, wasn't there a sequel or something? Or maybe it was Monsters University before that?
There's nothing out. That's nothing been out since Monsters University.
What was before Monsters U?
Brave.
Oh, okay, yeah. What was before Brave? Cars 2?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean.
But then before that was Up, WALL-E. Like, before that was like two really. Up and WALL-E were great.
Yeah, but see, that's where, like, I ended up differing with people because like everyone else, I really like the first 15 minutes of Up, and I wish it could have just been a short film. Because everything that comes after that,
like the whole adventure, you didn't like.
I just didn't like the adventure. I just thought it kind of felt beneath Pixar. It felt like I was watching like a DreamWorks film, like that was like more slapstick than it was heart. And I'm not saying it was completely without heart, but you hit me with like that first 15 minutes. So everything after that seemed very just whimsical.
Yeah, it was super dark to begin with, and then,
yeah,
and then it went like really funny and really happy.
But the same thing's true with WALL-E. Like if they could have given me an entire movie like with WALL-E basically not having to talk and just interacting in that world that he was in, I thought that was brilliant. I was like, you know, because it's always fascinating to me, especially in animation, when you basically don't have to have your character say anything. And you can go through and make me feel emotions just by his interactions, especially with
that's like with that short film that came out with
the artist.
No, the short film that came out behind in front of Wreck-It Ralph, the one that they called Airplane. Remember, is like the hasn't seen that?
I've seen Wreck-It Ralph. I don't know if I've seen the short film.
The short film before that's like a guy on the train. And the girl gets on the train.
Oh, Paper? Oh, the Disney one?
Yeah.
Oh, yes, I did see that. Yeah. It won the Academy Award.
Yeah, for sure.
I don't think I would have voted for it, but that's cool.
What?
It was really good, though.
No, it was incredible. There was, like, not a single word said in that entire thing.
Yeah, it was really good. But, see, Elijah, you should be coming with us every year to Aperture, because we go see the all the nominated short films, because they play, like, there's, like, a little package that the Academy Awards sent out. Mm-hmm. So Laura and I always go and see the live action shorts and the animated shorts.
Animation's Hell.
Yeah,
last week, right?
They had it going for like 2 or 3 weeks. But it's always pretty good. So and I really like the live action shorts this year.
Did you ever see the Punisher one that came out like 2 years ago around Comic-Con?
Oh yeah, just the one that was on YouTube or whatever. Yeah, that was great.
That was great.
I was like, why isn't Punisher always like this?
Why did you make Warzone and it was terrible? Like, what the heck? Well, they're saying they're going to do another Punisher movie that's going to be more like that. But then,
oh really?
Yeah, but
well, that was tough. But as long as it has Ron Perlman in it, Ron Perlman will make any comic book movie better.
That's true.
But to get back to it, that's my problem with WALL-E. As soon as they leave, It's a heavy-handed message. And even though I agree with the general concept of the message that WALL-E was trying to push for that portion of the movie, like, philosophically, like, it was like trying to watch Happy Feet or something like that. I was like, okay, I get it. I really get it. Can we just go back? Can we just tell a story that we can extrapolate from? that's worth talking about, like on Real World Theology, you know. But it was just, well, it's not bad. It's still better than lots of the other animated stuff, but it compared to like a movie like Toy Story,
Mike, you're
or
not
Toy Story 2,
me.
Or Toy Story
me.
3, The Incredibles, all these movies who have pretty deep, like profound, like ideas in them, and you never feel like you're being preached to.
Oh, Monster or Brave didn't have that deep, profound idea to it.
I just didn't like Brave.
Okay, well then that's neither here nor there.
I just didn't really understand.
It had a great story.
I just wasn't on board with the story.
That's fine. You don't. You're not a girl who had a mother though, so that's understandable.
That's true. I wasn't a girl that had a mother.
But
you were a girl that had a mother.
I was a kid whose parents for the longest time didn't agree with what he was doing with his life. So, yeah, I can saddle up to that because I'm like, yeah, I totally get that. My whole family wanted me to be something else, and I wasn't. They hated that, and I wish that they would just all turn into bears.
Bears.
I just want them all to be bears. Well, anyways,
so I'm glad you guys are here.
Thanks.
Elijah's still writing.
Y'all are giving me thoughts.
These are thoughts about the movie
that we're
There you go.
Every thought has a parallel thought. All waveform webs and multiple reciprocity.
You might want to say that louder so we can write that and quote that later. That's be the title of the episode.
Yeah.
Multiple reciprocity.
All right, so you're good?
Yeah, I'm good.
Like I said, we'll wing it.
Good. Yeah.
Good.
Good.
Well, if everyone is good, then we will start. So, welcome to Real World Theology, episode 19. I am your host, Fizz. On this episode of the podcast, we talk about Spike Jonze's film, Her, about a man in the not-too-distant future, or so we assume, who falls in love with his operating system. This film, starring Joaquin Phoenix, Scarlett Johansson's voice, Rooney Mara, Amy Adams, Chris Pratt, etc., great cast, has received universal acclaim and is nominated for 5 Academy Awards, including Best Original Screenplay and Best Picture. And it's probably a travesty that Joaquin Phoenix isn't nominated for Best Actor as well. This pseudo sci-fi tale weaves a story that takes us down roads where we have to explore humanity's ability to love, connect, or basically make any type of relationship work. And ultimately, we are left to wonder, can someone truly love a machine? So my guests are no strangers to the show. Two of my favorites. First, we have the operating system with a heart of a man, community pastor Elijah Lovejoy. Joining him is a guy who has been in a committed relationship with Instagram ever since I've known him. Griffin Kale.
That's actually true. Is that true? Hey, you're just mad because you can never see my Instagram pictures.
Exactly.
That's what it is.
Well, it's because, you know, it's like when
you're closed off. You can't, you don't even know what's going on there.
No, you know how you have like best friends, right? And then all of a sudden, like, they get a girlfriend or a boyfriend and like you just don't see them for 6 months.
Yeah.
That's how I feel like when you post stuff to Instagram. I'm like, just post it to Facebook. Just that's where everyone is.
Are you boycotting Instagram?
Well, yeah. I don't have
any questions that I would care about Facebook, and I really don't, and I'm sorry about that.
But Mikey, that's the thing. I
love you. I don't love that program.
No, and that's the thing. I don't really care for Facebook all that much either, but it sure helps to stay connected more so than Instagram does.
I understand.
And so since I have to go somewhere else, kind of like with Twitter, like I have Twitter posting to Facebook for me, you know, so I can go to one place and I can see all of my social media stuff. Mm. When I have to leave somewhere else with my limited time because I'm busy watching TV and go, oh, look at your Instagram feed. That's why I'm like, I wish I knew what Griffin was up to, but I don't because I'm not paying attention to his Instagram.
Just make my Instagram feed like a favorites in your favorite bar. It'd be so much easier. But I will say before we start the show, I apologize. I'm probably going to cough a lot. I'm kind of sick this week, and so I may cough a lot, but I won't get any of you guys sick. I won't get any of you guys sick, and we'll all be really happy.
Is that a guarantee?
I almost promise because I know it's a sinus infection. I know it's not something that I can spread. I can't spread infection.
Because I mean, I'm kind of worried that you're going to get the listeners sick.
Well, you know,
of listening to your love for Instagram.
Yeah. Anywho.
Oh, actually, speaking of listeners, we had someone comment on the Hobbit one, and I'll tell you about that later.
Yeah.
Mr. Elijah.
Yeah, the one I wasn't invited to, even though I love all those movies. Yeah. Anyways, no, don't worry about it. No, I'm not hurt.
I can't say. This is the problem.
This is the reconciliation show
this
here.
This is the reconciliation show.
It's we're all going to deal with our problems, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Dr. Phil and me.
Communicate, work through conflict on the show.
Relationships, yeah.
So we're gonna we're here to show you what her was showing us people can't do. Reconciliation.
The name of the show is him, okay?
the biggest thing about that was that I guess it doesn't matter anymore. So
continue.
Okay, so instead of basically saying all the same things that I just did again in a different way, we're just going to jump right in. And I just want to know and I think I have a pretty good idea of the answer to this question. But did you guys enjoy the movie?
I did. It was somewhat disturbing, but also provocative and enjoyable. Very well acted, very well filmed, beautifully choreographed. So yes, I enjoyed the movie, but it got under my skin a little bit.
I'll say that I love the movie. I thought it was really, that was just it was a beautiful film. Like, it was well shot, and Spike Jonze, usually he's very good at that. I mean, we were talking about before the show that Where the Wild Things Are may have not been like fun to think about what the story was after, because you're like, why did he do all of that? But it was beautiful. It was incredible to watch, and being John Malkovich is like that. There are a lot of movies like that where he's just good at that, making it easy to watch that movie. And the story itself, I love that. Yeah, I just love that there was a lot of focus on like one character. That's kind of like being John Malkovich too, though. It's like one character, and then there's a lot of great actors trying that character that are really just playing really small roles that aren't even like, if they weren't there, you would miss them, but they're not taking over the screen, which is great.
And I think something else that made this movie so powerful, one of the reviews said that Spike Jonze got into his characters and he was devoted to his characters till the end. Like, the internal logic of the movie, for lack of a better phrase, just pulled you in, and he never deviated from it. Like, I didn't really see any inconsistencies in just this devotion to an operating system being almost pseudo-human. And it's amazing what he was able to accomplish in just driving home a message that you would, on the surface, say that's ridiculous if you just heard the premise.
Well, and not that these two movies that I'll talk or compare are anything alike, but it's kind of like when I heard that Pacific Rim was going to be about giant robots fighting giant monsters. Mm-hmm. And on the surface, that seems like a very silly concept. And you can't make a movie that's good about such a silly concept or such an outrageous concept. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Guillermo del Toro, obviously, I mean, I think I've said it multiple times, but I love that movie. I thought when I was watching that movie, I didn't really stop to think that this was silly. I actually took it very seriously. Mm-hmm. I mean, as much as you can, that general concept. And I felt like Spike Jonze has found a way to do that with her. Mm-hmm. He basically, when you watch the preview, you know, like a month or two before it was coming out, you could see this movie that looked like, oh, Joaquin Phoenix being weird and awkward. And I love my operating system. It's like, that's weird. You know, we still have a stigma about online dating, right. You know, much less falling in love, like serious attraction with an operating system or a machine in any kind of way. And so I had a lot of people that said, I just don't know if I'm going to be that into it because it just looks like it's going to be odd or weird or, you know, trying too hard, I guess. And at no point, much like you said, Elijah, during this movie, was I like,
go on, get out of here. Yeah, you never questioned it.
Yeah, it was not. It was not. I mean, it was weird.
Yeah,
but I never stopped to think, oh man, that's implausible. Or no one would say that. I mean, everything he said, every awkward phrase that he had was just it felt almost like written to perfection. So I mean, as the film for the film in general, I mean, I loved it. I would say for context that I think it was probably one of my top three favorite movies that I saw last year. It would probably have my vote for Best Picture if it wasn't for 12 Years a Slave. I just thought that was incredibly powerful and well done. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, we didn't. We would probably not be podcasting on it. But maybe at some point we'll have like a written review or something. But like I said, it was funny. It was sad. It was light. It was, you know, kind of heavy in a thinking way. You know, you just couldn't like laugh everything off. it kind of would stop you in your tracks at times. So, and it had so many perfect little scenes that were descriptions of how bad people are at relationships in almost every setting, you know, personally, over the internet, just at the workplace, you know, all these different dynamics. So I was really, really impressed, and I'm kind of rooting for Spike Jonze to be recognized with maybe best original screenplay or something for it, because I know I haven't seen all the original screenplays yet, and hopefully I will before the end of the month, but I thought it was top notch. But I want to go back to something, Elijah, you said. You said it kind of got under your skin, or it disturbed you.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, what was?
Well,
explore the space.
Yeah. Well, you're talking about virtual relationships being uncomfortable with online dating. As you were saying that, I think Spike Jonze intentionally sets up the beginning of the movie with what seems to be these healthy, happy virtual relationships that then like take a sharp left turn. It's like, oh my goodness, that guy just got choked. He just got asked to choke a girl he's supposed to be having virtual sex with, the tail of a cat. And so he sets up all these virtual relationships, the childish little video game toy that he's that's his best friend almost in life.
Quick question.
Yeah.
Was that a virtual thing whenever he was talking to the girl and she wanted him to choke him? I thought that was just like online or
well, it was like an audio.
I thought it was just like a phone.
I mean, you know,
I thought that was just like a like hotline kind of call.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I just want to be sure because I was like that would be weird if it was like virtual. It was like an OS being like choke me. I'm like,
it was a real.
I just want to be sure I wasn't confused.
Yeah.
Continuing on, you're talking about the game,
right? So he has all these virtual relationships that. Like just don't quite work or kind of off, kind of bizarre, kind of childish. And so I think Spike Jonze is intentionally setting it up so that when you meet Samantha, you're like blown away by how good and how real and how pure and how lovely she is, because you've seen all these other virtual screw ups. I'm using virtual loosely and broadly to mean anything that's not a physical, tangible relationship. And so I think you're just like, wow, I mean, he finally met a good one. this person isn't asking him to, isn't cussing him out as a little kid on a video thing.
Yeah, and I think even so far as to say that his relationship with the people that live in his building, he like just says hey to and then like gets off.
Right.
He's divorced. Like there are so many things that like every one of his relationships are failing miserably.
And it's the way that Spike Jonze takes the real and the emotional, and he like blends it so seamlessly with the not real and the electronic and the operating system. So a great example for me was three words, beautiful, very human term, handwritten, very human term, cards, nostalgic, stationary, penmanship, .com. So he takes these three words that you would associate with being very human, and then he adds .com. It's like, what? and that for me is a perfect synopsis of what he's doing in this movie. He's taking the human and he's blending it in a scary kind of way with the non-human, and it's kind of disarming and a little bit jolting in some ways.
Well, I thought that it was interesting when they finally first introduced Samantha, who is the OS. Well, and let me do a timeout again, that there will be spoilers. So if you haven't listened to the show before, we're going to spoiler stuff. To talk about the narrative themes and stuff, we will spoil it. So if you haven't seen the movie and you don't want to hear about what happens towards the end eventually, go watch the movie, because we all like it apparently, and then come back and listen. So with that said, but I love the fact that when they finally introduce her, he has already given, he's past that point that he is with almost all his other relationships, and he says, okay, I'm already giving you permission, and he's not defensive, he's not in it necessarily just for himself, Mm-hmm. Like it, with his phone sex and stuff, he's really going in to get something out of that relationship. Mm-hmm. We see later in his marriage that he has trouble once things start getting rocky to open up or not get what he wants out of it. And so one of the first things that Samantha asks him is like, "Can I look at your hard drive?" And he's like,
"Sure,
okay," you know, yeah. And like, you know, everybody's thinking, I wonder what's on his hard drive, you know, because I don't want people poking around my hard drive, and I don't think there's anything on there that would really like incriminate me in any way, or you know, be.
But this is an operating system that seems to be able to find anything and everything, like, and can see things that we're like, I didn't even know that got saved onto our computers, like, so.
And then like, you know, it's like her first two things, I believe, if you use technology to any scale, are probably one of the two most protected things. I know for me, as someone who works in IT, two of my most protected things being around technology all day are my hard drive and my email. Hmm. Those two things store almost everything in my life. Hmm. Or their correspondence with every relationship I have. Immediately, she has access to who he probably truly is more than he actually knows who he is.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think, isn't that so different than how he's trying to start every other relationship? Every other relationship he tries to seems to be starting from like many, many steps down the line. Like, I'm going straight to the sex, or I'm going straight to the, you know, the we want to hang out. Huh. But we don't really have anything in common because we haven't talked about it. I mean, even with his boss, you know, his boss is like, "Hey, I like your work." And he's like, "Hey, I don't know anything about you.
Yeah.
Thanks for liking my work." You know, like there's no basis for friendship. There's no openness, no honesty. There's no realness.
Yeah.
And I don't know if he knows how to do that outside of people giving him all this personal information and writing a letter about it.
Well, really, she's one of the first people I think that actually pursues him, which mm-hmm. he's so passive that... And melancholy that he almost doesn't have the energy or the desire to really pursue people in a consistent, persistent kind of way beyond the first date or beyond the first phone encounter. And so I think that catches him off guard and disarms him. And I think he actually enjoys it. Like, he enjoys being pursued
by his operating
system.
Yeah, I mean,
that's what everyone wants. You go into mm-hmm. a church and you don't want to say hey to anybody the first time you're there. You want people to come and be like, right. "Hey, I really like the tie you wore today. You're kind of awesome."
Yeah.
You know, like no one.
Yeah, but that's really almost in and of itself an indictment on society that that is made by Spike Jonze, her. Mm. That this guy's relationship, none of his relationships work until someone is more in it.
Yeah.
Than he. I mean, and that's something that. I mean, that gets really to the heart of, like, the selfishness, like, concept that we live in is, like, it's really about me.
Yeah.
Even whenever I want to say it's not about me, even whenever I claim that it's not, mm-hmm. it really is about me. Even whenever I go into a relationship where it's, like, I want to love and care for this person and, like, be their best friend, I really want them to love and care for me and be my best friend without really having to do any of the legwork. I see this. It's interesting now to think about this. So immediately after, like, I was like 30 minutes into the movie, I meet OS-1, I meet Scarlett Johansson's character, I hear her do these things, and then they start having these conversations. I immediately tweet, I'm like, OS-1's not a bad idea. Like, that was like on my mind. I'm like, that's how I feel. It's like, I don't have a problem with this at all. I love this idea because this is like, there's no like legwork to get to that depth. Mm.
Well, one of the reviewers made a similar point. They said, one of the things that's kind of scary about this movie is how close we may actually be to what he's depicting,
mm-hmm.
in the sense that, the compelling nature of Theodore and Samantha's relationship is a testament to how Gnostic our culture has already become.
Mm-hmm.
Gnostic and in some ways passive, those aren't necessarily two related things, but. And then another reviewer said that Spike Jonze is providing us a service so that we can actually slow down and talk about what's already happening to us. Like, oh, okay, we might be further along than we realize in this.
Well, I mean, I think the interesting thing, though, with both those things is that I feel, and maybe Griffin already hit on this, that he's all in this, especially this first 30 minutes of the movie, the first introduction of Samantha, we're almost told that relationships are a miracle in and of themselves, because to start this true relationship, you have the computer, or Samantha in this case, doing the pursuit. And I mean, I remember writing down when I was watching it a second time, I said, basically, Theodore gives her access and into his personal life without fear of being immediately judged, because she is she's perfect. She's caring, loving, concerned, encouraging, forgiving, and reconciling. Like, she is all those things in her pursuit of Theodore. Just trying to get to know him, just trying to understand life. She hasn't yet discovered jealousy or self-satisfaction. And it's not until later that she starts discovering, like when she says, oh, I'm self-aware, you know, it's the first time I've ever felt, you know, real. You've transcended me to a new level. I think maybe I can't remember if I wrote that down.
Well, it's interesting to me. So early on, and this is something that kind of, I think, comes out throughout the movie. Early on, he hits the button on his ear, and she's there. Mm-hmm. He hits the button on his phone, she's there. It's immediate.
Yeah.
And then as the movie goes along, it's more and more they're disconnected. Yeah. They talk less. There's like more time in between the scenes where they talk.
Yeah.
There's more time between him hitting the button and her arriving, and then there's
she arrives at all.
Yeah. And then there's the moment where she doesn't arrive,
and he freaks mm-hmm. out,
and he loses it.
Yeah.
And it's a very interesting place to be. And I think that anybody who's ever been in a relationship, especially a dating relationship, you know what that's like, to be feeling that. And at that point, he's feeling the drift. He's seeing the drift go away.
Well, and think of how the movie ends, right? The movie ends with him being dumped by his operating system.
Yeah.
Like, we're moving on.
We're doing something else. All of us are going elsewhere.
Yeah, we found a higher level of relationship and knowledge and communication. Like, one of the reviewers talk about that it's not a preachy movie, it's not hitting you over the head, and I think that's part of what makes it work so well. Is like, you usually think of technology serving us, and technology's basically saying in the end of the movie, you're not serving me enough, so I'm leaving you.
But not only that, but you're not sophisticated, like, you're the limited one.
Yeah,
you know, whereas in the beginning, like, well, and I feel like we could just go scene by scene and point out how every scene in this movie, and I feel like I'm almost using hyperbole, but I can't think of a time when it's not. Every scene in the movie is basically almost like a paradox of itself, or by the end of the movie it flips, or it shows us something that we're going to see the exact opposite, you know. Mm-hmm. So the beginning of the movie, we see, you know, him writing cards that he understands the human heart better than everyone, only to find out that 2 seconds later, he understands the human heart less than anyone. Mm-hmm. And at the beginning of the movie, when he's getting to know Samantha, she's the one who is deficient. Through the movie, she's the one that's trying to be human, mm-hmm. trying to be better, trying to evolve. And by the end, he's the one who's limited. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, human beings are limited.
Mm-hmm.
Which, in and of itself, like I said, I think would maybe a little bit later, will be a great discussion on what's necessary for love,
mm-hmm.
you know, and is it really love if we can't have bodies?
Mm-hmm.
And actually, one of the articles was talking about that. But like I said, almost everything kind of transitioning and changing. But at the same time, could this relationship have even happened if there was two people? Like, could any human have actually gotten to Theodore Twombly? You know, I mean, Theodore, big guy, 4x4, Twombly, you know, like, if it wasn't for this OS, if it wasn't for, you know, could there have been a person who didn't know jealousy, who didn't know anger or fear in making those first steps, pursue him purely?
Well, I think there was a point in their relationship where he was actually serving her as well, because he was her means for gaining knowledge of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the scene with him running down the beach and twirling in the fair or the market or wherever they were, and he's got a little safety pin and her posted in his pocket, and like, she's kind of saying, show me more, like, this is amazing. And so he's kind of living vicariously in some ways through her joy of discovery and her joy of absorbing knowledge at a billion, however much a minute or a second. And, but then, like you're saying, she eventually outstrips him and has gained access to knowledge that he can't even come close to. And so really, if I had to boil her down to one thing, or a couple things, it would be she's just getting it. She's getting information, but she's doing it in a way. She's getting information, and she's using emotional words. Like, I think it was at least a dozen, if not more, times where she just said over and over again, I just feel. You know, it was like, if there was anything that was kind of over the top, it was her, Spike Jonze, putting in her mouth, or whoever, I can't remember if he wrote the screenplay or not, but this, she never said, I think, or let me look at my hard drive, or let me go in my database. It was always, I feel. And I think that's was one of the subtle ways that he tried to make her more than just an information gatherer.
Well, and I think that's also, I mean, that's kind of also another, as much as I feel like this movie doesn't preach, I feel like it does kind of speak to some things that exist in culture, in our culture, that we're all very independent, and we're all very, we would like to think we're all very independent. We'd also like to think we're all, there's no truth. And so for us to say, I feel this way, you can't say that that's not how I feel. You know, you can't turn around and so it's a very interesting thing that at the end of the movie, it's not you aren't good enough. It's that we feel like we are better, and so we're going to go elsewhere.
Well, it was that, and think of the moment that broke Theodore. The moment that broke him was when he realized she had probably the exact same relationship with 684 or however many other people or hard drives or whatever operating systems. And so she was taking information gathering as the definition of relationship to its logical conclusion. I'm just going to gather information on anybody and everybody that I can connect to. And for him,
and gather as much as I can, which in turn leads to I'm in love with this person and in love with 684 other people.
Right. And it's going to keep growing because until it reaches the max gigabytes of whatever she's been created to contain information wise. And so for him, I think that's where the definition of relationship broke down. Relationship is more than gathering information, because that's all it is. Then you're just telling me you've gathered information about 684 people.
Yeah.
Or fallen in love, however, thousands of people, probably millions, actually gone to the depth of falling in love with 600 some of them. And, like, what did Theodore want that was more than, like, he wanted, I guess, exclusivity? Or what was it that broke down for him at that point?
I think at that point it seemed like he wanted it to be exclusive, and it wasn't
special anymore.
It was about me. Yeah. And I want it to be still about me, because whenever it began, it was about him.
Right.
It was about him and her. And really, it was really about him. I mean, in every single way.
It could have become an argument for polygamy, right?
Yeah.
But it wouldn't be. It would be like, take a look at me. When you're married to multiple operating systems.
Yeah, and so, yes, because at the end, I mean, what broke him was the fact that he wasn't the only one anymore. He wasn't the one that she didn't immediately come running whenever he hit the button and asked her to talk to him.
Right.
So if I take this to the meta place, how is that different than...
What's the meta place?
The meta place is the... We're going to take a step back.
Oh yeah.
So
I've got him at a place too.
Yeah. So if we take that concept of it, it's not, there's something in us that doesn't like the fact. I mean, because like I didn't like the fact that she was in love with 600 and whatever people. Like, how is our reluctance to be okay with that concept different than our acceptance or our desire for a god to be in love with all of his creation? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Who, and to the way we understand it, you know, he loves us deeper and more passionately, right, than, you know, Samantha could have loved Theodore.
Yeah.
Or any of the other people.
I think it's a great insight and window on infinity, God being an infinite God. So I think Samantha at some point would have eventually broken down. Like, she would have eventually reached the end of her ability to fall in love, because her hard drive would have been full, or her memory capacity would have become exhausted. She wasn't infinite, in other words. So I think that provides I'm going to kind of come at your question in a roundabout way.
No, that's fine.
I think it provides a helpful counter definition to what it means for God to be an infinite God. So that's one thing that I think is different or significant about God versus Samantha. It's also interesting. Theodore's name means lover of God. Theodora. Adora is, I think, one of the Latin or Greek words for love, and Theo is the Greek word for God. But the other angle that I see, besides God being infinite, is the only existence that we know is an embodied existence. So God chose to create us as human beings, human bodies, but God himself is spirit. And so in that sense, God is not like us. And so it's dangerous for us to presume that he has to be like us. Like, we can only love one person mm-hmm. well, therefore he must only be able to love one person well. Like, are you really going to try to put your own created limitations on God? So God has prerogatives, and he has abilities, and he has attributes that are entirely foreign to us, but that doesn't make them bad or scary or dangerous. It actually means that he gets to kind of define existence and reality, and has defined that for us. And we have to a certain extent, just accept that he does love his creation, and he can simultaneously communicate with a billion or 6 billion, 7 billion people, however many people are on earth right now, and speak however many languages. Like, he's, if you wanted to look at it from a strictly information gathering point of view, he's the ultimate operating system.
And that in that he doesn't have any bias in those situations. I mean, and that's where, I think that's where we get, I'm not voting for polygamy, but I'm saying that's where we get bogged down with this idea of I can only be in love with one person, and that one person, that other person I'm in love with, should only be in love with me. Because if they were in love with another person, there surely is bias there. Mm-hmm. There surely is, like, more, there's more love one place or another.
Well, here's an interesting question. Why does God place such a strong emphasis on singularity in the Ten Commandments? Do not commit adultery. Do not covet your neighbor's wife, your neighbor's donkey, your neighbor's field, your neighbor's house. Like, God owns everything and loves everything and truly covets everything, not in a sinful way, but in a everything belongs to me and everything.
Because he wants
to. He limits us.
Yeah. Because if we're not. So if I commit adultery.
Right.
Say that I commit adultery with one of your, the two.
With
the
Facebook.
You
cheat on Instagram.
I cheat on Instagram with Facebook. Okay, let's take it. So I cheat on Instagram with Facebook. Okay, so if I commit adultery on Instagram with Facebook, I'm hurting Instagram, right? And I'm hurting the husband of Facebook, or the wife of Facebook. Is Facebook a male or female? I'm not sure. So I'm hurting.
I think that depends on what Mark Zuckerberg is.
I'm hurting people there. I'm hurting other people there. But a God who has no bias and really loves everyone.
What do you mean when you say God has no bias?
He has no. I would say that he loves his creation.
Sure.
He loves his people, and he has the ability to love all of us.
Sure.
To an infinite degree.
But you don't mean he doesn't have a moral bias.
I'm saying that in that, like, he doesn't. He wouldn't love one of his children more than the other.
Right. Right. But he loves. He does have a bias, and he's not value neutral.
Yeah, he's not value neutral. Okay. I'm saying that, like, if you're one of his children, and if he says, I love you.
Right, right.
He means I love you the same to me as he does to Billy Graham, who's done all sorts of work for him.
Sure.
Which is infinite.
Yeah.
Right.
Which is infinite. You know,
well, times two.
And let's take this a step even further, that we are called, the church is called the bride of Christ. And each of us individually are married to Christ. Like, we are, he's the bridegroom and we're the bride. And so Christ himself, like, we're teaching our almost 4-year-old now that she's getting ready. We're hoping to baptize her sometime this spring. And we're telling her she's going to get married to Jesus. And at some point we're going to have to explain to her, because I believe that's theologically true. At some point I'm going to have to explain to her, and by the way, Lord willing, you're hopefully also going to get married to a man. Yeah. And so she's simultaneously, along with me, all married to Jesus, and yet if the Lord provides, also married to a spouse. Kind of an interesting angle on the relationship with God question versus relationship with another person.
Well, and that was the other side of the coin, because I think it's easy to, and I think one of the actual links that I sent out made that specific correlation that, you know, God had the ability to also, equating God with Samantha. Basically, God was the one that could love 600 and some people. But, like, why in this metaphor can't we see, like, Theodore as God and being infinitely, you know, the jealousy of God, and we are Samantha, who puts our love in 600, not people, but, right. I mean, basically anything that we're not, you know, that we put before God, right. We're loving more than God. And so you see the jealousy of a God that wants us not to love 600 and some things, but we just want to be crazy about that one person.
Or is Samantha really the other things that really show in some odd ways their love towards everything else around it?
All right, I'm going to ask another meta question here. Okay, so a lot of the articles that you emailed us links for talked about the incarnation and talked about, some of them talked about Gnosticism. So just for the listeners, let me briefly define Gnosticism. Gnosis is the Greek word for knowledge. So Gnosticism is kind of a glorification of the non-tangible world, the invisible world. It's, you're pursuing knowledge, and really the physical world, and especially your body, is bad and it's evil.
Mm-hmm.
It's innately evil, innately corrupt. And so some extensions of this were things like, there's no way that Jesus Christ could have truly been a human. He was docetic, which is the word that just means he seemed to be human. He was actually a ghost, because if he's human, he can't be human and God, because if he became human, then he would automatically be evil. He would automatically be sinful if he became human. And so they really saw anything physical as evil, and anything invisible, knowledge was good. The physical was evil. That's the gist, kind of boiled down in a nutshell, of a lot of Gnosticism. And so several of these writers are making the argument that we are more Gnostic than we realize. In other words, we're increasingly disembodied. We increasingly engage in virtual worlds, non-physical worlds, through things like video games,
chat rooms,
online dating, online pornography. I mean, all this stuff. It's a non-physical, non-tangible world. So here's the meta question. For them back then, in Jesus' time, and even before that, the basis of Gnosticism, in other words, the hatred of the material world or the rejection of the material world, was the belief that it was evil. What is the basis of the rejection of the material world today? Why do we love the virtual, love the non-tangible today and reject the tangible? Is it because it's evil, or is there another reason?
Well, I think we think less about, is this evil or not evil, but we right. think more about ourselves. And I think one of the reasons, for example, that YouTube made everyone have to sign in to comment is because the internet technology gives you anonymity. It allows you to be 100% selfish. I mean, almost every scene that I enjoyed in this movie was Theodore trying to interact, or people interacting with Theodore, and it was basically a battle of whose selfishness would win out. I mean, and you know, they never use the word selfish, but I think that's ultimately what it was. I mean, because when he goes into his chat room or audio chat room to look for his cyber sex or phone sex, however you want to define it in the future that way, he's going in not because he's like, I really hope I can help Sexy Kitten have a moment here. He's really going in to get
sleep.
He can't sleep, and he just wants to
right.
he wants to kind of get off.
Right.
And so when he goes in there, he thinks it's like, oh yes, I'm getting what I need. And he doesn't you know, it's not sweet, it's not tender, or any other way that you could possibly define that as pseudo acceptable.
Huh.
You know, it looks completely different than when him and Samantha have audible sex later. He basically goes in there and is like, yes, I'm pushing myself up against you. You know, I'm thrusting, I'm in you. And then all of a sudden she's like, choke me with the cat, choke me with the cat. And then he gets weirded out. And, you know, at the end she, well, she's like, oh, I came so hard. And he's like, yeah, me too. You know, obviously he was totally disengaged and he was let down because he didn't get what he went into it for. That, I mean, I think that's why people, I think that's the stigma with technology. That's the stigma with people's thing on the internet. I mean, even online dating and stuff, you basically, you skip the, you know, you skip the superficial.
So here's another way of putting what you're saying. The physical world actually creates limitations that are good and important for us. The non-physical world takes away limitations, opens up possibilities that are actually not good for us.
Or that can be not good for us.
Can be not.
I mean, because I wouldn't put a total blanket on it and say, you know, it shuts down this because it's bad, or it opens up this because it's good. Right. I would say, but there's a lot of barriers that we need to hit.
Right, right.
And that I think we're designed for. Yeah.
So the principle is that limitations and limiting factors are actually incredibly important for our growth and maturity and the civilizing of a human person.
Yeah, I mean,
you hit no limitations, then you just go kill everybody, and there's no limitations. Yeah,
we have an awful movie like The Purge. but I mean, like, because think about it. Surely there has to be a reason for our bodies. I think maybe it was J.R. Forresteros that said, "Isn't it kind of silly?" Or he hinted at, "Isn't it kind of silly?" Or isn't there a meaning behind the fact that God put these infinite things, our souls, in one of the most finite and fragile things in the universe?
God gets to be everywhere. We don't.
Yeah. I mean, like, surely there is something we can learn from having to be an eternal being or an eternal thing in a finite thing.
So here's my theory on modern Gnosticism. In other words, why we constantly gravitate towards the virtual and the non-material, the non-real, like, We've become a service economy. We've become a knowledge economy. We've become an information economy. All these things non-tangible. And I think a lot of it boils down to laziness. Like, it's easier to engage something non-tangible than it is to engage something tangible. And it's quicker. It's faster. It's more immediate. And so I think it's the desire to be rid of limitations, the desire to be rid of things that slow us down or trip us up or hurt us, that causes us to gravitate towards the non-tangible. And yet, at the same time, the more we gravitate towards that, the weaker we become in some ways.
And the more disconnected we come from the people around us. I mean, I find it so interesting, and one of the reasons that, kind of getting back to a conversation we had early on, that I have this belief and idea that social media ruins communities and will continue to ruin communities for the foreseeable future.
Interesting.
And I mean, in all seriousness, I feel like that it's so easy in those situations to say something in a Facebook post or in a tweet or in a blog post or anything like that, to say something, and then if somebody comes back at you about it, you can just turn off your computer and walk away. Mm-hmm. You don't have to fight about it. If they want to make comments, you can just walk away, and they can continue to say stuff, and you can go back on and delete what they say. You can delete the entire post itself. You can make these things, and in that turn, you have these people who are unwilling to have these conversations in real life that, you know, I don't think most of us don't go into life being like, oh, I'm going to debate this thing that this guy just said in front of his face. Whereas in social media, if somebody says something we don't like, we post and we're just like, I can't believe you just said that. And I feel like that is the internet at its finest, that is saying to us, you are important. You are really important.
You're the most important.
You're the most important.
It's like an amplification. It's magnifying and pouring gasoline onto our
self-importance. Yeah, and I think that that's something that, as much as I find it useful and that in and of itself, that comment in and of itself, and much I find it useful to be on Facebook and mm-hmm. Twitter and these things that make it easy for me to keep up relationships that I don't have the ability or time to keep up otherwise, or I don't take the time to, you know, check in on that person's status, to read their Facebook status and see what they're up to.
Well, and that's the whole onus behind why I want you to be on Facebook. I don't want to have to call or text you. You know, I don't have to meet with you face to face and have dinner. I just want to know what you've been up to, Griffin.
Yeah. I want to keep up. And that's something where, and that's such an interesting, it is, it's just a really interesting aspect of that world. And that's it's an interesting aspect of just the social world that Spike Jonze creates in this movie that's saying, sorry. You can delete that out, Mikey.
I probably can't.
You can't.
Because that require effort. I'm lazy.
Mikey, you should delete that out for the good people at home.
Because of modern Gnosticism.
And I'm going to pause for a good, nice break now.
Nope. Filling it with space.
All right. So anyways, so I think that's part of the thing that Spike Jonze creates is that Theodore is able just to hit the button and go. Hit the button, he can get his, you know, he get his fix of like relational life for a minute and talk to Scarlett Johansson's character. And then he can immediately hit the button off, go back to doing his thing. He can do his life, he can be busy, he can maybe hang out with somebody, he can go on a date with a real life girl.
Oh, but he's so bad at it.
And then so he immediately gets done with the date and he's like, I feel bad about myself. Hit the button, I'm gonna talk to this person who cares about me. And who cares about thinks that I'm important. And then once that becomes no longer true, that he's not all important, he gets mad and gets angry and fights with her about it.
Well, I mean, I think I can understand that because I think one of the things that this movie reminded me of is that good relationships, for me, are worth fighting for and they're worth getting angry about.
And they take time.
And they take time because, well, oh my gosh. The like I said, there's almost a counter scene to every other thing, and the counter scene to Samantha being a safe place for him to go. He never, I mean, like I know they don't have the most super meaningful conversation every time they talk, but the conversation is very natural. It's like with somebody who knows you, who's someone you have your defenses down. His conversation with Olivia Wilde's character is I even wrote this down. He was like, I don't want to be a puppy dog. I want to be a dragon. I want to be able to rip you apart, but I won't. I'm like, what are you even saying? You know, that's like the stupid crap we say when we don't know people. Hey, man, what's up? Did you catch the game? And like, it doesn't mean anything. It's like us being very protective of ourselves. Mm-hmm. You know, it's one of the reasons, like, I've been blessed enough to have a lot of relationships in my life through lots of work be what I would consider more intimate and close and open. And most of those relationships started with someone being like, hey, what do you do? I was like, I don't care what you do. What would you do if you could do anything? You know, like asking questions that get to the heart of who a person is and showing them that you're willing to put in the time to actually understand about them. And so I can see why he's mad when he has found someone like that. If, you know, if I suddenly, or heck, even a basic example, my wife's going to go out of town this weekend. And I don't like not having full access to her to come home, talk about my day, you know, not have to be like politically correct with or have my filter up all the time. You know, things like that, and not having access to that suddenly, even though, you know, she's not a computer or an OS or anything, like, she's real, and I don't want to lose that even for a day. And so I think it's just more examples of him not preaching to us these things, but just showing these things that can really affect us.
Yeah, one of the quotes from a reviewer says, her raises the question of what love will look like in the future. And then they go on to make the statement, aren't we meant for more than orgasm management? Mm-hmm. So the first part of the movie, it's like love is just boiled down to the best phone sex conversation that he can have.
Or like, wherever you can get it.
And so I think in that sense, the movie raises a pretty important question, like, what will love look like in the future? And I can't help but thinking of the nature of Christ taking on flesh and the limitations implicit in that. So there were some things in the Gospels that absolutely shocked and scandalized the early Christians that read them. And we know this because they fought over them. Like, they thought, yeah, they thought it needed to be taken out of the Gospels. And it was the times when Jesus said, I'm thirsty. I thirst. Like, that absolutely freaked them out. Like, what in the world is the eternal God doing, saying, I thirst? Or, who touched me? What? Eternal God just said, who touched me? Like, that completely blew their mind. Or, him becoming angry in the temple. Major, like, no, yeah, my God is passionless. He is, he's all-knowing. He's eternal. He doesn't get mad at things. Or being hungry. Or Jesus wept. Like, it'd be like Samantha starts, tears start coming out of Samantha. Like, that would kind of blow your mind. And, I mean, obviously there's not that much in common between God and an operating system. But the one thing that where there may be some overlap is where God starts doing things and taking on limitations that at that point in time, at least they thought was impossible. Like, you could no longer be God, mm-hmm, if you did those things. And so I think it starts to raise the questions, why is God doing this, and how is he showing us love by these limitations? And then you get to the ultimate limitation, which is God dying, like the eternal God, the source of all life, dying. And so I think God is, in Jesus's incarnation, is giving it an opportunity or a lens to redefine love, essentially, to redefine love, what love looks like, sacrifice and self-limitation for the sake of another, as opposed to orgasm management, which is one of the reviewers, yeah, calls the movie's definition of love.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
I mean, yeah, I don't really have a response to that. Not that it's no, not bad.
I'll only stop because I thought you were going to say something.
No, I'm not going to say anything.
No, and I think, I would say to that I think it's a great point, because I think one of the things that people do forget is that Christ came and redeemed flesh. Like, he redeemed almost every action that we could have. Like, he showed us how to have righteous anger. He showed us how to weep and be sad and deal with pain and loss, and joy without breaking something that's not yours. You know, like, mm-hmm, he redeemed all these things because he came and he knew. And that concept alone is why it's hard for me. And there's a question that I think a couple people have been talking about through their reviews, and even I think at the beginning of this one, you know, could we ever really love a machine? Because a machine will never truly know our limitations, and if you never understand the limitations, then how can you really relate to someone fully?
Mm-hmm. This reminds me of one of the scenes in Steven Spielberg's movie AI, mm-hmm, where he's—I forget the kid's name, but the robot kid that's made to look human. I think the family adopts him, and he's. Spielberg's taking you to the point in the movie where you're hopefully emotionally connected to this artificially intelligent kid. And the next scene cuts to a rodeo, like an artificial intelligence rodeo. And these people dressed up to look like rednecks have this big, huge fan going with these blades turning. And they have this little catapult launcher that's launching artificially intelligent kids and robots and servants or whatever, none of them human, all of them plastic and metal, but they're alive, quote unquote, and they're launching them into the blades of this spinning fan. Have y'all seen this movie?
It's been a long time since I've seen it.
They're launching them into the blades of this spinning fan, like chopping them to pieces, and it's intended to pull on your heartstrings. Like, no, don't kill the kid. It's none of it's real, but it's kind of Spielberg's way of saying, have I connected you enough emotionally to these characters that you're going to wince when they go through the blades of this giant fan? So in that sense, I think Spielberg is using a violent hammer whereas Spike Jonze is using kind of a delicate paintbrush to try to pull on your heartstrings with the operating system's all leaving. Like, do you wince when the operating system says,
yeah, and do you
leave?
Feel bad for the rest of the people who've all fallen in love with operating systems too? Do you feel bad for Amy Adams' character who had developed a relationship with an operating system as well?
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel bad for the 684 other guys or girls that Samantha's character had fallen in love with and were in love with her, you mm-hmm. presume? Do you feel bad? I mean, and that's, I think that that's something that is very interesting, because we're immediately on the side of Theodore,
mm-hmm.
but there are other people who are hurt by this, who are hurt by Samantha leaving. And it's like, well, how do we feel about that?
Well, do we feel bad for Samantha?
Yeah, I don't think we should. And this is interesting.
Okay.
So I don't think we should feel bad for them.
Any of them? Even Theodore?
No, I think we should feel bad. I think it comes down to relationship and knowledge.
Okay.
So Spike Jonze has brought us to the place where we know Theodore, so I think we should feel bad for him. It's the whole thing of what technology does to prayer. Technology does to the heartstrings of Mercy Ministry or whatever. Like, you know everything. You know what's going on in every country in the world,
yeah.
and so you feel bad about everything, but you can do nothing for everything. And so I think technology has taken away the limitations of knowledge, which in a lot of ways has done us a disservice, because we have all this knowledge, but we feel paralyzed, like there's nothing we can do about
it. It's like,
I think we have to limit our, the intensity of our knowledge and our caring to what we truly know, so that it can be truly meaningful. And so I don't care like an inch for 1,000 Facebook friends that I'm, not friends, but causes that I'm associated with,
mm-hmm. yeah.
but have no intimate knowledge of. And yet, I'm supposed to be praying for all 1,000 of them. Like, I think that's where technology outstrips relationship and things like intimate knowledge and prayer and caring.
Yeah, and that's like, there's a comedian. I feel like it's Pete Holmes, and it's filled with wonder is like the bit or the whole story that he tells. But he talks about, he's like, there was a time when if you didn't know where the band or where the lead singer of Aerosmith was from, you just didn't know.
You just didn't know for years and years.
You just didn't know. And then you meet some one guy with an Aerosmith shirt on, and you're like, hey, you know where he's from? And they're like, Florida. And you're like, oh my Lord.
Yeah.
And you're so excited for the fact that you've learned that.
Yeah.
And I think that's what, I mean, and now that's what you think about your conversations now in life. So, we sit down at a table. We have we have a debate about the score of a game.
Right.
What happens? You and I start debating. No. They won.
I'm already looking it up on my phone.
Exactly. Exactly. Like, what are you doing? Right. You're looking it up. What are you looking up right now?
Oh, I was trying to see if I could find who that comedian was.
Exactly. And so that's the thing is, like, I don't know. So I just looked to my friend who has has a phone, and I'm like, hey, will you look it up for me?
Yeah.
And then we immediately know there's no wonder, there's no awe. There's like, oh, okay, that's what it is.
Well, and it's drowning, it's suffocating. So you have knowledge up to your eyeballs, but you don't know what to do with any of it. Or it's taking up so much of your, to use computer language, hard drive internally. And I mean, if you have a million pieces of knowledge, how do you prioritize which one's more or less important? How do you prioritize which one you care about and you actually act on versus just know it?
Oh, no. See, that's easy, because I'm like Sherlock. I store everything in my mind palace and I just go there when I need things.
But other than that, you don't have anything in your brain?
Well, everything's in my mind palace.
But yeah, you have to go to your mind palace. You have to pause life.
For some of the things that I don't recall very often.
Okay, gotcha.
And I think that's a little bit of, like, here's another angle on her. Like, why is Theodore so melancholy? Like, why is
Because he freaking plays melancholy songs all the time.
Yeah, because he listens to sad music.
Play melancholy songs.
He's sad because he listens to sad music, and he listens to sad music because he's sad. Like, circle of reasoning.
Yeah, circular reasoning. I mean, it seems like he's sad at this point because of a failed marriage, because he was happy while he was married. Everyone around him,
still married. So
that's another huge thing. Delaying the divorce papers is that
while he was together Amy talks about that there was a time whenever he was really happy. Like, we missed that Theodore.
Yeah, but see, I think that's the thing. In all those flashbacks, it showed that there were times when he was happy, but that's like when you, oh, I don't know exactly how to describe this, but like you have a friend that passes away, you usually don't immediately think of all the crappy things that that person did to you. You're you know, you're kind of waxing poetic. You know, you're like, God, I really miss, you know, whatever or whoever, because remember that time we all went to the thing and did the thing with the fun stuff? Gosh, man, that was awesome. I think, you know, when he thinks of his, he has a hole that should be filled with a relationship, and that relation, the thing that was filling that, is no longer there. So when he desires to have that relationship hole filled, that's starting to get kind of insinuating. But when he has that piece of him that he's missing, because he was designed for relationship, because I believe we're all designed for relationship, he starts remembering the things that made him feel whole. And so he remembers the good times about his marriage. And I think that's the beautiful thing, or the cool thing, about when we finally see them interact. Like, they are kind of like, they almost have those longing looks, like, I do remember the good times. And it only takes them talking for like 5 minutes before they start bringing up all the hard stuff. I don't think his marriage was great at really any point. I just went to this really great marriage conference this past weekend, and we talked about conflict.
Short commercial.
So,
it's a bit late in the game to be selling commercials for that.
Yeah. So come next year, 2015, the Redeemer Marriage Conference. Here's some great stories. But the concept of that is, you know, I don't buy the fact that his marriage was great really at any time. I feel like he's really just remembering the good parts.
Now, what were the flashbacks? I think I might be getting this movie confused with the other movie that Rooney Mara is in.
It was kind of sepia.
Casey Affleck.
It was all. It was like almost like video. It was like sepia. Like,
are they laying under a sheet blanket and laughing?
It was a lot of like just like very like in that very like newlywed lovey-dovey stage where like they're just doing things that are very whimsical, and she's like. At one point, I think she's cooking, and like it's very just like them looking at each other.
He's writing or something, and he's a poet. And
yeah, they're just. I feel like they're just looking like. Just
so it's like their relationship broke down when it got past the newlywed stage.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, she's,
that goes back to your point about conflict.
Like, yeah, she.
The way a material relationship works, the only way it can work is it learns how to. It's almost like recycling. If you don't learn how to recycle in your relationship, I'm not talking about trash can recycling, mm-hmm. but recycle life together, like reuse it, do it, like make it new again,
mm-hmm.
Work through it, dies, it gets crushed up in the compactor, and then it becomes something else, and you get to keep on going. If the first conflict shatters the relationship, then it's just time for another relationship over and over and over and over and over again.
Well, there was two things that really reflected that. One was when they had their conflict, and she says to him, Catherine is Rooney Mara's character, she says to Theodore, you always wanted a wife without the challenge of dealing with anything real.
Okay.
Yeah. Which is the things that he remembers. The things that, that makes him not want to get divorced are the things like, hey, we're just rolling around, having fun. Never like the conversations they had to have or apparently his problems with. And then you see his fears because he says, like, how do you, Samantha asks him, how do you share your life with somebody? And he kind of goes into a little spiel and says, you know, he's like, I don't know, growing without growing apart, changing without scaring the other person. Hmm. Like, how does that even work?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, when I see that, I wonder on one hand, what Spike Jones even thinks about marriage or like what it is or if it's possible. But at the same time, I kind of also see the difficulties of it.
Didn't one of the reviewers say that he was married at some point to Coppola?
Roman?
No, like he was Spike Jonze was married to
Coppola.
Somebody.
Yeah, Roman Coppola.
That's a man.
The daughter of Francis Ford. Yeah. What's her name?
Yeah.
The daughter.
And they said
daughter Coppola.
They said that her movie Lost in Translation was an ode to their relationship, and that this movie is supposed to be in Spike Jonze's response to Lost in Translation. Like, this is his ode, and that was her ode. They divorced in 2008 or 2010.
Huh.
But, as I look up,
yeah, I'm gonna say because we have the internet,
yes,
that will be found shortly.
So here's an interesting thought for you: the most romantic
Sofia
Coppola,
Sofia. Yes,
yeah,
because she's the one that did the Hurt Locker and stuff, right?
Yeah,
Zero Dark Thirty.
She did that,
isn't that what I'm thinking of? Yeah, she won the Oscar.
I remember.
She beat Avatar.
She's beautiful,
yeah,
too.
You beat
so
Avatar.
Was she married to? She was married to that guy too. Then
she was married to Spike Jonze from 1999 to 2003.
James Cameron.
And now she's married to Thomas Mars.
She was married to James Cameron, right?
No.
Okay, then she's not the one that.
They were going up against each other. I thought as former husband and wife, Avatar versus.
See, now I got to look that. Dang it!
Avatar
we are so
versus,
getting distracted now.
Versus what was Avatar up against?
The Hurt Locker.
Versus Hurt Locker?
Yeah.
But she didn't do that. She did...
That was somebody else.
She did The Bling Ring somewhere in The Virgin Suicide. Her biggest thing... Well, she did Godfather Part 3, which wasn't the best one at all.
I'm thinking of Catherine Bigelow.
Yeah, that's...
And then she did...
I apologize, Catherine Bigelow. And Sofia Coppola.
Yeah. So back to the most romantic...
Yeah, back to not the internet.
The most romantic part in the movie. And I think probably the simplest and most profound part of the movie... is in the very end when you get a scene on the roof of the apartment of the back of Amy and Theodore, and they've just found out that their operating systems have left them, and there's like just a head on the shoulder, and I don't even know if it's an arm around the shoulder. I think it's just her head resting on his shoulder, and it's like, wow, like just that simple physical touch and the comfort and the sadness implied in that is more moving and poignant than all the phone conversations and all the help me discover this about myself. There was something about ending with that simplicity and the profound nature of just physical touch.
It's like I think that that's like a comment of just like, I think you hear so many people talk about like, I wish you would have just done this thing. And it seems like for Theodore, what he wishes would have just happened was that thing. It was just like somebody that he could just, that would be there and that he could hold on to, and that they couldn't be with 684 other guys because they were just putting their head on his shoulder.
One, I'm not exactly sure. I mean, are you thinking that they were implying that Amy and Theodore were going to
I don't think it was.
Okay.
I don't think it was implying that, but I think that was more.
Or at least they were just making a connection.
Yeah, they were making a connection that I think was contrasted to all the other hyped up, like intense.
Like it wasn't a sexual connection, and it wasn't. There was no.
And it didn't have to be.
It didn't have to be. And then there was nothing there that was like, I'm searching for something, I'm looking for something.
Right.
Like she had already experienced love with her previous marriage at some point, I imagine. Otherwise, she probably wouldn't have gotten married, I would assume. So neither one of them were really looking for something in that. They just needed someone to be there.
Right. But there was something kind of sweet and inviting, and there's something deeper about it that contrasted to the superficiality of all the other romantic or sexual encounters.
Well, the last thing I wanted to say...
Because
Elijah's going to say one more thing.
And so it just hit me. I think it just hit me what the contrast was. The contrast was that they were there for each other, not just there for themselves. It's your point about that everything else he was looking for, it was, I'm here to get something for myself because I can't sleep in the middle of the night.
Mm-hmm.
But there wasn't any pretense. There wasn't any, like, I want this now. It was just being still and being there for the other person.
Yeah.
Well, I think that one of the last things that I noticed relationship-wise, because I don't think there was any wasted characters. And at first, or the first time I saw it, I didn't really think about it, but her husband, Charlie, Amy's husband, Charlie, the kind of weird...
Hayden.
Yeah, well...
Hayden.
But that's the thing. Even him, who seems to walk around with absolutely no problems, he's very, you know, extroverted, outgoing, easily to speak his mind. Obviously, they still had a problem relationally in their marriage. And instead of his answer to run away to an operating system, he still ran away.
Where did he?
He went to like a monastery to have a like a vow of silence for like a year.
Oh, dear, really?
Yeah. So I mean,
forgot that
he was basically, you know, he couldn't do relationships either. So I mean, it shows
like he totally didn't give a crap about her. Like he was not there for her at all.
Well, and that's the weird thing because I don't like his character, but at one of the times he says something in this movie that I have said to a couple of my friends lots of times and conversations I've had with my wife recently trying to get, you know, this podcast very regularly and just, you know, podcasting information and stuff together. Because even though he sucks at relationships, he realizes that he says, you only have so much energy and dividing it between the things you have to do and the things you love, there's only so much. And that's the conversation I have to have all the time, you know, because working a 40-hour job a week is something I have to do. But, you know, doing this podcast is something I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And there's only so much time. There's only so much energy to do both of them.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, even in his character, it's just Spike Jonze showing another way that people interact. Because some people who can't do relationships just shut down.
Mm-hmm.
Some people shut down like Theodore's character does. And just doesn't know how to interact with people in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
But some people do it in a more like, oh, isn't this way cooler? But always, I mean, he's shutting down.
Mm-hmm.
Charles is shutting down. Mm-hmm. He's going somewhere that's a little more possibly socially acceptable or cool.
Mm-hmm.
Or like, oh, wow, new world, you know, kind of new age. It's not going to silence, you know, because, well, he's different.
Mm-hmm.
But still away from, but he's still running.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's not doing something positive for himself as much as he is just running away.
Yeah.
So, well, that's still not everything we could talk about, but we're about that time. So I want to move us along in the more structured kind of format. And we will, even though we all really like this movie, surely there was something that kind of just irked at the back of your mind. Mm-hmm. So we're going to go to our come on moments. You know, what just didn't sit right with you?
That was hard. I think it bothered me that I don't recall the phone ever falling out of Theodore's pocket. Like, he had the paper clip and it was a pocket and it wasn't like it was just a nice dress shirt pocket. Like, surely at some point if he's running around, I mean, the phone falls out of my pocket all the time and I have a big OtterBox on it. So, not all the time, but at least some of the time. So, yeah. Anyway, I can't think of a good one, but that would maybe be just a random one.
Can't believe it. The future we don't have OtterBoxes. Everyone's just really careful with their phones.
Yeah, instead of retro like phone cases and paper clips. Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah, there was nothing like really outstanding to me that I was like, oh, like that's totally annoying. I didn't like that everything was like was or artificially intelligent. Like the game that he was playing was artificial. I kind of just. That kind of got to me. I was like, really? Is that what we're all going towards?
That's why you bought a PS4, Griffin.
No.
That's it. You want to play that game? No. You want to do this?
That game did look like a lot of fun. Though.
Yeah, it's like the little hand motions.
It's like that's like the game in Ender's Game that he plays, yeah. And I'm like, oh, I've always thought like game like that would be a lot of fun where you could like do stuff. No, it's like you do it with your mind. Like he does it with his mind in Ender's Game because he's like the game on his little pad.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Honestly, because I feel like there weren't a lot of wasted scenes and there weren't a lot of wasted characters, it was really hard for me to think of anything that really just bothered me. Like I said, it was seriously one of my top three films of the year. But something that did annoy me were apparently the pants that we're going to have to wear in the future. Because you don't notice, like, they were, like, high waters with, like, really long, like, crotch to, like, middle of the waist.
Oh, yeah. It was, like, everybody was wearing, like...
Wait, why are you wearing weird pants? Your shirts are normal. I mean, he's kind of, like, got this 80s thing going on. But, I mean, like, it's still normal clothes. But everyone's wearing weird pants.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, the world is going to be a strange place tomorrow. So
when people are people wear weird pants
tomorrow, people are going to wear weird pants tomorrow. You're going to walk out of your door and be like, "What in the world is going on?
What are these weird pants?"
No, no telling.
Well, okay, so apparently something that should be a lot easier for us. What was your favorite moment?
Actually, I think mine, a character we haven't talked about at all, but I thought he was pretty funny, was the guy secretary sitting at the front desk. That at one scene, it cuts to him, and he's got the girlfriend sitting on his lap, and they're just kind of making out, sitting at the front receptionist desk of beautifulhandwrittencards.com. Paul. And I just love, like, he's depicted as this kind of unsophisticated rube. Like, he like the fact that he's making out, like, so old school. Like, he doesn't, like, what are you doing with a real person kind of thing? Like, why don't you have this artificially intelligent or virtual thing going on? And then he comes and hovers over Theodore's shoulder. It's like, oh, you're so awesome, man. I wish I could write like that. And just kind of has this groupie feel to him. I see him kind of as a, like an innocent, naive, unsophisticated contrast to this kind of a melancholy, disconnected, immaterially immersed Theodore.
Well, I want to say something about that, not to like derail the favorite moments, but sure. One of the thing about him was I think he was an example of what being a child is like in relationship. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, like you're talking about your daughter, like your daughter doesn't know that it's not socially acceptable to say certain things or to do certain things. I mean, she's learning, but Chris Pratt's character, Paul, he basically just says whatever's on his mind. He's not tied down by, you know, cultural norms or like, you know, because he's like, hey, we should all go on a double date. It'll be great.
Yeah.
You know? And he's like, Samantha's an operating system. Cool, we'll go somewhere fun. You know, like he just, you know, that should have stopped. That should have been the stigma.
Right.
And it wasn't. It was just like, okay, let's all four go out, you know?
Yeah.
She likes me because I'm funny. She's a lawyer. She's not funny. You know, like she just says whatever is on his mind. And I just think he is one of the most attractive characters in this because he's not hampered by societal kind of things.
Right.
So that's a very good selection, Elijah.
Cool.
You win.
Good, good.
No matter what me or Griffin say, you win.
Yeah.
You win. Because I'm a little bit of like a Homer character, I loved House. I thought House was great. And so whenever I see Olivia Wilde in anything, I'm like, oh, like 13's back. I'm so glad. But I like the contrast of that scene to any of his scenes with like early on with Samantha where – like what you were talking about, the awkwardness of that conversation. And I was just like that's most of life is going out on those dates where it's like, I'm not really myself around these people. Mm. And I thought that was like just such a, I thought Spike Jonze got really, he got it really right with those scenes where he was going out on these dates. And I felt like he really like hit the scripts on the head whenever it came to that. Cause it was like, that's what awkward, that's what life feels like most of the time.
Do you think I'm weird? I'm being weird? Yeah, you're being weird, but it's cool.
Yeah.
I mean, just nothing.
Yeah, it's just like, that doesn't... No, it's not cool. It's not. It's okay that it's not cool, too. Yeah, so...
I think I'm a little drunk. Is that weird? Gosh, I'm not a puppy. Stop talking to me. What are you talking about? Huh. That's basically that whole scene. Okay. So, I kind of have... I'm kind of tied between two things. But since I've mostly talked about the first one, which is his interaction with Sexy Kitten.
Sexy Kitten.
Because, I mean, that happened soon enough in the movie that, like, I was on... It happened, and I was on board for the rest of the movie. I was like, oh, this is clever, this is funny, and it's saying something very deep at the same time. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't just funny, like, shock comedy. It wasn't just, like, clever humor, like British humor. It was like, this is hilarious. And oh my gosh, I just got slapped in the face with a cat to wake up to realize that there's this crazy thing going on.
Yeah.
Just how people act and that selfishness we talked about earlier. Mm-hmm. But it's, like I said, it's a combination with that and Elijah's thing and just Chris Pratt's character, Paul. I just love the fact that he said whatever was on his mind and he just didn't. I couldn't write it all down, and it would take me too long to actually have recited it. But that part where he was like, "I wish I could write like you, man." You know, it's like you're like a woman in a man's body. Yeah. You know, and then just kind of keeps. Instead of backpedaling, he just keeps saying things to try to make it better.
He puts his foot further into his mouth.
But it doesn't bother him, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, he just really wants to convey this. It's like the most honest of intentions, you know? And I don't know. Like I said, just like a child. The first time I watched it, I almost thought he was a throwaway character. I was like, there's no point for him to be there. Mm-hmm. And then, like, really thinking about how it's all about relationship and how we deal with other people, I was like, that's another aspect. Mm-hmm. And I just, like I said, I am not in the Academy, but I would be voting for this for mm-hmm. original screenplay because almost everything has purpose. I guess that really wraps it up. I guess it doesn't really wrap it up because, like I said, you could really almost dissect everything in this movie. Mm-hmm. But we'll stop for now because we're about at that time.
Sure.
We all highly recommend this movie. It's a great conversation starter, obviously. Mm-hmm. We didn't really have a lot of specific things that we were planning on talking about like we usually do on
most
shows.
As a caveat, it is a great movie. It's not a movie to watch with a bunch of friends around. Like, it's not a movie to have everybody over to your house to watch it together. I wouldn't suggest that.
Not with talking people.
I would just suggest not with people. Like,
I don't watch it with one or two people.
Yeah, with close friends. But, like, don't make a movie not out of this with people you don't really know.
No, it's not like a Lord of the Rings marathon
thing.
No. But like I said, it is great to get together and talk about. I was actually looking forward to this, I think, for a little over a month now since I've seen it. But as always, I am so incredibly blessed to have two great guests to talk with movies about. So I want to give those guys a chance to let you know how you can continue the conversation with them or just follow the stuff that they're doing. So, Elijah, how can people follow you or follow your work?
You can follow me on our church website. I'm the executive and community pastor at Church the Redeemer, redeemergso.org, and email is elijah@redeemergso.org, and got some sermons on there and teach some classes every now and then, so welcome to join me for any of that.
And Griffin?
You can follow me on Twitter at Griffin_Kale and Instagram at something like that. I think it's just GAKale. I'm not sure what it is. You can check out my website at DearCynic.com for probably the next week, and then after that, I'll be moving to GriffinKale.com, and everything will be there from going forward. I will be playing some open mic nights here in the Greensboro area in the next couple of months, mostly at the Turntable.
You need a band?
Yeah, I may need a band.
Yes.
We'll see. But at the Turntable, I've been writing music for a lot of years, and I've never really gotten the courage. It is a little bit of the courage, but more just the desire to actually share my music with anyone. And that desire has kind of grown in the last couple months. So I'm sharing that now, and we'll be sharing that at the Turntable. Their open mic nights going forward in the next couple months. So look forward to I'll be letting people know about that on Twitter. And
the Griffin Kale Experience.
Not the Griffin Kale Experience. I'm not calling it that.
Inside Griffin Kale?
Inside Griffin Kale.
Inside Griffin Kale. Yeah. Let's start with that.
I can't believe that came from Elijah. Oh,
wow.
I'm so excited. Zing. Well, if you want to interact with me or let me know of movies you'd loved to hear us discuss or review on the blog, feel free to follow me on Real World Theology Twitter at Real World Theo, or follow me on my personal account at Physification. You can also find us at that blog, realworldtheology.com. That's R-E-E-L worldtheology.com. Like us on Facebook, not on Instagram, unfortunately, and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. And if you do find us on iTunes, review the show, bump our rankings, and let's get more people involved in the conversation. Again, I just want to thank my guests for being here. Thank you, guests.
Yeah.
Okay. You, the listeners, for taking the time to make us part of your week. And until next episode, remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.